So here at Zen Center, we've always been open to learning about forms of Buddhism other than Zen, and even integrating practices from other Buddhist traditions into our own. There are many Buddhas, of course. We talk mostly about Shakyamuni Buddha, but there is Amida Buddha, Maitreya Buddha, many others. And this morning, we have an opportunity to learn something about Amida Buddha and the Pure Land tradition, which is the most widespread branch of Japanese Buddhism. And it's my honor this morning to introduce my friend, Reverend Todd Tsuchiya, who is a minister's assistant at the Twin Cities Buddhist Sangha, which is in the Jodo Shinshu tradition. And that is a group that has existed in the Twin Cities since 1946. And it's affiliated nationally with the Buddhist Churches of America. And some of you will recognize Todd from an event we had in March when Duncan Williams was here to talk about his book, American Sutra, about the Japanese-American experience during World War II. We co-sponsored that event with the Twin Cities Buddhist Sangha. And Todd helped us to organize it, and we did a service together at that event, which was very nice. And I see some other members of the Twin Cities Buddhist Sangha are joining us today. So a warm welcome to you, and a very warm welcome to Todd.
Thank you, Ted. Can you hear me okay, Ted?
I can.
Okay, great. I'm going to just try to share my screen here. Very good. So thank you, Ted, for the invitation to speak to the Zen Center community, and thank all of you for logging on today. I do see some familiar names from your community as well as from our community. So that makes me a little more nervous because now I'm accountable for the things that I say. So anyway, these are just real quickly here. I need to, during these times, throwing a few cat photos or pet photos is always helpful just to calm us down a bit. So these are our cats, Mochi and Bodhi. And during the quarantine, since we've been home so much more, we taught them how to fold origami cranes for the upcoming Buddhist-led vigil. So pretty good, right? No opposing thumbs, opposable thumbs. So they were able to do that. And the paper crane is a symbol of peace, love, hope, and healing during challenging times. So that's their contribution to the vigil and also to today's talk. I did sneak on a little early and was able to participate in your last session of sitting. And it's just amazing to see the dedication and the commitment that of your members. So thank you for allowing me to log on. Ted has graciously participated in some of our Sangha events and most recently spoke at our service last month. And in our exchange of talks, without realizing it, I think we were speaking about a very similar topic that's important to each of us, and that's about the connections between our communities and our traditions. And I'd like to start by giving you my disclaimer and for letting you know that I'm not an expert, and hopefully I'll not grossly misstate doctrine in either tradition. So once I'm done, I will refer you back to Ted to correct all of my misstatements. Shin Buddhism speaks about our relationships with our fellow Sangha members, and the Japanese term are ondobo, ondogyo, and it means being fellow travelers. So it's a tradition developed for the common person. So as a Shin minister, I'm not someone to work through or to overcome, but really a fellow traveler on the path. So I'd like to begin my talk, as is customarily done in our tradition, to quote a passage, but instead of using words of Shinran Shonin, who is the founder of our tradition, I'm going to break with tradition a little bit and read a passage I've often heard from a person, a minister, Shin minister. His name is Reverend Ogui. And I'll tell you a little bit more about him later on in my talk. And so this passage is, "It is indeed true that one's life is not only one's life, but a life of others' sacrifices. How can I share my life with others? And to me, this is an understanding of Shin Buddhism that I'd like to share with you all today. And when Ted spoke to our Sangha last month, he talked about some of the more frequently mentioned differences between our traditions. And one of them is the idea of practice in Soto Zen focusing on meditation. And in Shin, it's on the Nembutsu. And another difference he spoke about is self-power and other power in our respective traditions. And as Ted mentioned, I think these distinctions may be misunderstood as there really is much more overlap to them. And I'd like to layer this idea of overlap with an emphasis of the interconnectedness between the Zen Center and our Shin Sangha, as there is much more than I think many of you may realize. So I hope to open your hearts and minds to think broadly about your own benefit, your own beliefs, and wherever you are in your path, and can reconsider the labels that you might carry. And in society, you know, we live in a very measured world where we're constantly making comparisons and building walls. You know, nothing more accentuated than our recent times. But many of our problems today do seem to stem from the dualism of our societal inclination to make people or groups into the other. And this isn't consistent with Buddhist truth. And Buddhism says there are innumerable paths to liberation. So I can never claim a monopoly on the truth. And Buddhism encourages me to abandon fixed ideas rather than to cling to them. So hopefully I can help you see our interconnectedness and help blur any lines of separation. So let me start by telling you a little bit about myself and our Shin Buddhist Sangha. You know, Jodo Shinshu Buddhism is the largest denomination in Japan, as Ted mentioned. And it came to the U.S. with the immigrant community from Japan in the late 1800s. So it's been here quite a long time. And the term Jodo Shinshu means true essence of the pure land teaching. And the institution that we're a part of is called the Buddhist Churches of America, or BCA for short. And it was founded in California in 1899. It was originally called the Buddhist Mission of North America, BMNA. And the name changed as a result of the World War II imprisonment of the Japanese Americans and the Japanese Americans' attempts to try to fit in or become more, you know, American. And at that time, being Buddhist was really considered a national security threat. And to be American was to be Christian. And it's a longest-standing Buddhist organization in the U.S. And our group in Minnesota is called the Twin Cities Buddhist Sangha. It was founded in 1946, as Ted mentioned. It was right after World War II. And it was founded by those relocating to Minnesota from the internment camps. And also there are many Japanese American U.S. soldiers stationed at Fort Snelling at the Military Intelligence Service Training Base. And for those of you who might be unfamiliar with this history, Fort Snelling and Camp Savage were the home of the Military Intelligence Service that trained American soldiers in Japanese language to be interpreters during the war against Japan. And they were all of Japanese descent, as they had familiarity with the Japanese language. And as a reminder, these were American citizens serving in the U.S. military while their families were imprisoned because of their race. And several of my family members were stationed there at one point. So my family is from California, but moved here after being released from these prisons since they had lost everything they had owned. And they're originally members of the Twin Cities Buddhist Association. They're original members of the Twin Cities Buddhist Association. So I guess you can say I was born into the tradition. And this photo on the lower right is from the 50s, and it's from the Star Tribune. I guess back then it was either the Star or the Tribune. But it's the Japanese American Community Center that used to be in South Minneapolis on Blaisdell Avenue. It was owned by the Episcopal Church. And this is on the right is Father Otani, and he was the priest of that church. And then on the left is our religious leader, who is Shig Tsudasaki. And they share the space for religious gatherings. And interestingly, Father Otani used to live right on the shore of Betabakaska, you know, Lake Calhoun back then, just a few buildings down from the Zen Center. And we're a very small sangha of about 50 families that meets twice a month through Zoom, like everybody else is doing now. And we don't own a temple building to call our own. And before the pandemic, we met at the Midtown YWCA in their community room just down the street from that burned down third precinct. So being portable, we set up our altar wherever we go. And that's a photo of our altar on the right side of the screen. And so my journey with the Zen Center, I think this picture is probably pretty old, but it started with a class I was taking at the Institute of Buddhist Studies. And so this is the Institute of Buddhist Studies, what we call IBS. And that's not irritable bowel syndrome, by the way. That's the Institute of Buddhist Studies. It's a graduate school and seminary in Berkeley, California. And my professor in this class was Charlie Pokorny. And I think some of you know him or have met him before. And he serves as one of the head priests at Stone Creek Zen Center in Greaton, California. And he also has ties to San Francisco Zen Center. And he recommended that I go to a Buddhist center different from my tradition to experience ritual. So I showed up at the Zen Center's door, and that's where I met Ben, and who subsequently introduced me to wonderful people like Ted. I see Jeremy was on this Zoom call, you know, Amy and Jeffrey, amongst many others. And these connections led to several collaborative efforts, including like what Ted mentioned, our Sanghas jointly hosting Duncan Williams last winter. I think that was the last public event I probably attended before the pandemic. I think those of you who attended would agree that it was a meaningful experience for us all. We were able to share a service together. And we've also had opportunity to interact with causes that we're both passionate about. So these are photos from the upper left is from the march shortly after the death of George Floyd. And then the others are from last winter, the ICOM vigil at the Whipple Building. So I'm grateful for our karmic connections and these experiences together and really exposing me more to the Soto Zen tradition. The Jodo Shinshu tradition may be new to many of you, so I'd like to give you just a little more background and give you my perspective on some of the difference that Ted talked about in our talk that he noted about on practice and self and other power. So the Jodo Shinshu is part of the Mahayana and Pure Land tradition and has its origins in Japan, started by its founder, Shinran Shonin, at the same period as Dogen's Zen tradition. And this was in the 1200s during the Kamakura period. Both Dogen and Shinran rejected their prior Buddhist practices to answer the challenges of the day. And for Shinran, he rejected the practices he was trained in as a Tendai monk. He was discouraged in his inability to attain awakening after 20 years on Mount Hiei. So he saw the futility of trying to overcome human calculation. So he came down from the mountaintop and met his teacher, Honen, who made the Nembutsu the primary focus. Just this photo, just a quick explanation. This is a very large metal cast. I don't know if it's bronze. I can't remember. Probably bronze, but a statue of Shinran Shonin. And this is in front of the New York Buddhist Church. And the significance of this is several statues were cast prior to World War II in place throughout Japan. This one was within 2 miles of the epicenter of the Hiroshima bomb blast and withstood the bomb. And so this was donated to the New York Buddhist Church, which was a significant undertaking. And it was dedicated, and one of the main speakers was D.T. Suzuki at the time. And you can see some of the markings are due to the proximity of the blast. And I understand, although it's a safe statue, that you can still, they can still, with measuring devices, sense the radiation effects on the statue itself. So Shin Buddhism starts with the fundamental understanding that we're inherently foolish beings, or the word is bonbu in Japanese, driven by our ego nature. So Shinran's Nembutsu practice is grounded in a lay tradition, you know, a householder tradition designed for the peasant community. And the basic understanding of Shinran's teaching is to gain self-awareness, to understand our human limitations. And Shin is not about trying to get rid of your attachments. We want to treasure the blind passions because they can be deepened into wisdom and compassion. So awakening to our ordinariness, our foolishness, and our karmic bondage is in itself wisdom. For Shinran, enlightenment is difficult, if not impossible, to realize as we are. But what is possible is the attainment of something called Shinjin, or true and trusting in the other power of Amida. And this is the ever-folding awakening to one's nature and of the activity of wisdom unfolding as compassion. And this is what Shinran calls birth. So Shinran's teaching is not usually discussed in terms of uncovering our Buddha nature or realizing our Buddha nature, but that we simply receive the light as wisdom of Amida Buddha. So Shinjin is letting go of all attachments which enables the natural unfolding of wisdom and compassion. So let me spend a little bit of time explaining Nembutsu, since that's the word I've been using and many of you have probably heard before. So for Shinran, the idea of practice was considered the recitation of the Nembutsu. And it was something simple, could be done by anyone, anytime. It was especially available for the peasants or the people who were previously thought as undesirable due to their birth or their work in life. It didn't require you to set aside time to do this. It was to be spontaneous. So Nembutsu practice has its roots as a meditative practice. And the term Nen in Nembutsu means to think on, and Butsu is Buddha. So it means to think on the Buddha. And Amitabha, considered the most compassionate Buddha, was the focus. So Shinran rejected these early versions of Nembutsu practice, not because they were not effective, but as ordinary humans with blind passions, we can't achieve them on our own as our human calculation gets in the way. So Shinran said the important thing is to understand the working of the Nembutsu, and that is not generated by the practitioner, but it's the call of Amida within each of us and the response to that call. So Shinran took what was considered a Buddhist practice, the recitation of the Nembutsu, and he turned it into something that was no longer a practice, but a recognition and then a state of being. So what is Nembutsu? And it's the recitation of the name. So Namo Amida Butsu is what it is in Japanese, and it's the name of the Buddha Amida. And it can be described in many ways. So literally translated, Namo means to take refuge, and it implies Amida's aspiring and directing virtue. And Amida Butsu is Amida Buddha. Amida is considered all beings, and Butsu is Buddha, meaning the recognition of the awakening of all things. So more generally translated, it means I trust myself in the Buddha of infinite light and life. And light and life are considered as the representation of great wisdom and compassion embodied in Amida Buddha. So maybe more practically speaking, for Shin Buddhist, voicing Namo Amida Butsu is really an expression of gratitude. And instead of asking for something we desire with the saying of please, if we think of it in terms of gratitude, it creates a shift in the direction of thinking. We change our reality by seeing what is already here, and the change occurs inside. So thank you describes the essence of the Nembutsu by acknowledging gifts already received. So the foundation of Shinran's approach to awakening is the practice of shifting our mindset from the attitude of please to the reality of thank you. And what the Nembutsu is not, is it's not a petitionary prayer or mantra. It's a means of communication between a relative being or a consciousness and the Buddha deep within. Now, all it sounds like, it is generated by the practice or like a prayer to some deity. It's not. And it's not recited to gain any merit, but it's set out of gratitude for what a follower has received from Amida Buddha. And the Nembutsu is really considered the Buddha's practice. And Shinran even said that the Nembutsu is neither practice nor a good deed. I know it's contrary to what I said that's considered, Nembutsu is considered practice, but what he said was it's not a practice by which we get enlightened, nor is it a good deed as a means for merit or acclaim. So I've talked a lot about Amida Buddha, but who or what is Amida Buddha? In the Pure Land Sutra, there's a Pure Land Sutra on the Buddha of Immeasurable Life that tells the story of the origins of Amida. And in the sutra, it tells a story, it's a legend of a king who desires to seek out enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And he denounced his throne to become the Bodhisattva Dharmakara, who made 48 vows, contemplated them for 5 kalpas, or just a really, really long time. And by fulfilling his vows, became Amida Buddha, establishing the Pure Land for all beings. And the benefit of a Pure Land or a Buddha field is that due to ideal conditions of being in the presence of the Buddha, one can attain enlightenment. So this is a story or a legend to allow followers to encounter the Buddha. Amida is not a historical figure like Shakyamuni Buddha. Amida does not live in temporal time. It's neither considered male nor female. And it's represented anthropomorphically to help us understand as Amida is not really a person. So that's why Amida is also represented as the name, which is the scroll on the right side of the photo there. And that says Namo Amida Butsu in characters. And Amida is not a deity to be worshipped. It's not a divine savior, and it's not a supernatural power. So Amida is the combination of two Sanskrit words, Amitabha and Amitayus. And so the prefix, just getting a little too nerdy on the etymology, the prefix A is negation, and Mita means to be measured. So A and Mita means not to be measured or immeasurable. And Abba is light, and Ayus refers to a lifespan. So Amitabha is the Buddha of infinite light, and Amitayus is the Buddha of infinite life. These are symbols of wisdom and compassion. So Amida is said to come from the combination of these two words. So Amida Buddha is the Buddha possessed of unlimited light and unlimited life, symbolic of infinite wisdom and compassion. And Shinran understood Amida as Buddha nature. And as he put it, Buddha nature is none other than Tathagata, or suchness, or true reality. And this Tathagata pervades the countless worlds. It fills the hearts and minds of the ocean of all beings. So for Dogen and Shinran, it really wasn't a question of how to attain enlightenment, as that was a given. And the issue was more how to recognize it, how to practice it. So for Dogen, as I understand it, one does not use meditation or sitting as a means to achieve enlightenment. One sits in order to express, acknowledge, or fulfill the fact that one is already identical to the Buddhas. And just as Shinran would say, the Nembutsu is an expression of the fact that one is receiving the light of Amida and is equal to the Buddhas. So at this level, maybe their idea was not very different from each other, but the nature of practice was. And both had new formulations of practice as no practice, and they were expressions of what was already there. And so just quickly, just some other rituals in our tradition that I think have meditative components. In Shin, rituals are not done to gain merit. They're done in preparation for Dharma listening. But if they're thought of as like good acts, they become a hindrance to this understanding. So these are lists, the offering of incense, gassho, and chanting, as well as deep listening. So these are rituals that you're probably all somewhat familiar with or have been exposed to. So the incense part is offering of incense is an expression of gratitude. And the smoke represents the transiency of all existence, and the smell is symbolic of purification. And it's a reminder that all things are changing. So when all else has disappeared, the wood, flame, and smoke, the remaining fragrance teaches us Dharma. And when offering incense at memorial services, we're reminded that a loved one's physical form has disappeared, but through our memories, thoughts, and feelings, our connection to that person remains. And so the smell of incense symbolizes Buddha Dharma, or truth that awakens us. Gassho is a gesture we as Buddhists do with our hands, and I know you do that as well. It's usually, for us, is usually done when reciting the Nembutsu for Shin followers. And it's an expression of reverence, gratitude, and respect. So putting your right and left hands together is putting opposites together. And it's symbolic of the Dharma, of the truth about life. And we place a nenju, or a mindfulness beads, around it, and it recognizes the oneness of the two. And chanting, of course, is a very large part of our ritual, and it's embodying the teachings through sound and vibration. And I know that's a part of your ritual as well. So this is just the first page from a chanting book we use. This is the Juseige, which was what we chanted when we were together for the event with Duncan Williams. So the chants that we do in our tradition are done in classical Buddhist Japanese language. And what that is a form of Chinese characters without the Japanese grammar. So it's actually somewhat difficult to translate directly. So native Japanese language speakers have a difficult time understanding it by just trying to directly read it. But it can be said that chanting is not done to read and understand, but it's a participatory ritual to collectively appreciate the wisdom beyond comprehension. So to engage a path is not just intellectual learning, but involves our whole being, body, heart, and mind. And so one of the places that we can do this is through chanting. And I think of chanting as neither active nor passive. It's more receptive. And so chanting together is moving beyond self-centeredness. So we chant together to receive the power of no self or emptiness. So rather than being the instigator, the chanter is the recipient of the power of awakening, the recipient of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion. So one last thought about Jodo-Shinshu practice. Practice is also considered deep hearing or listening to the Dharma. And listening to the Dharma is not just the Dharma we hear with our ears during a service or a talk like this, but the Dharma in our hearts and in our life around us. And it is receiving the Dharma. And that's why Sheen speaks about our practice as living life or being engaged in our lives, as we're constantly confronted with the truth of reality butting up against our egocentric views. So, you know, there's certainly many meditative components in the Sheen tradition. So to say that Sheen does not have any meditation, I think it may not be completely accurate. And to move beyond form is part of our growth as Buddhists. So it's not the concern about the ritual itself, but what I am seeking from it. And this is just this is something I have hanging in our house. And this is a Japanese calligraphy that I received from a minister in our tradition. His name is Reverend Koshi Nagui. And in Japanese, it's waza wo motte, waza wo koeru, which means with technique, go beyond the technique. And I interpret that to mean to go beyond form. And I wanted to show this to you because Reverend Ogui, whose quotation I used at the beginning too, is somebody who I want to talk about. And I think we'll take a little deeper dive into our relationship together. So the term I used in the description of this talk that was on your website was Zen Shin. And this is the combination of terms Zen Buddhism and Shin Buddhism. It's my understanding that it's a made-up term attributed to this guy, Reverend Ogui. He's a prominent Shin minister in our tradition. And Reverend Ogui, this term he came up with really carries with it an interesting story that relates to our Sangha's relationship. So he's an 18th generation priest in the Jodo-Shinshu tradition coming from Japan. He came to the U.S. in 1962, and he served in our institution, the BCA, and he's been our overseeing minister in Minnesota in the past. So, and he also became the bishop of the BCA, which is the highest ranking minister in our institution. So his opinion really carries a lot of weight, but he's currently retired. And Ogui Sensei tells a story about his initial influences or difficulties as a Shin priest in the U.S. in the 60s. And he was very discouraged and he wanted to go back to Japan. But then he met Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco. And at that time, Suzuki was taking calligraphy lessons from the wife of the current bishop of our tradition. And so that connection is how they met. And Suzuki invited him. He understood the difficulties Ogui was having. So he invited him to just come sit Zazen. He said, come sit with me. It might help you. He said, there's nothing wrong with practicing meditation. So, you know, it was unusual for a Jodo-Shinshu priest to sit Zazen at a Soto Shu temple, but for Reverend Ogui, it was not unusual. So just a little backstory, Ogui's sensei's father was a Shin priest in Japan, and his best friend was a Rinzai Zen priest, and they used to hang out together, and they created programs together for their village. So his father used to send Reverend Ogui to this Rinzai temple to practice. And he wanted him to be exposed to practice from a wider perspective. It seems sounds pretty progressive for the time. And he said, Reverend Ogui said, it was an exciting time to go to Sokoji. And that was where he met Katagiri, the founder of your Zen center. So Reverend Ogui attributes his long career as a Buddhist priest because of Suzuki's influence. And that started with the suggestion of just sitting with him. So Reverend Ogui said, the breakthrough for him regarding his frustration in his ministry was that he thought he was discouraged because he was lacking in English skills and lacking in his understanding of the Dharma. But what he realized in his interactions with Suzuki and Katagiri was not that he was deficient in knowledge, but it was because there was something lacking in his heart mind. And this turned his frustrated life into being more alive and what sitting did for him. And so their friendship was very deep. Reverend Ogui even gave a eulogy at Katagiri Roshi's funeral. And he's also has published essays about Suzuki after his death. So Reverend Ogui, while serving at a Shin temple in Cleveland, he actually started a Zazen group there. And that is where the name Zenshin Sangha started from. So he received quite a bit of criticism, of course, from the BCA community, but he framed it as a combination of Zen practice and Shin awareness. So when he was asked about his the difference, he said, "Someone told me once that Zen teaches you to be present, and Shinshu teaches you that you have no choice, that you can't escape life." So I've been fortunate because I was given a chance to practice both. I enjoyed the feeling of calmness and peacefulness that came from Zazen. And at the same time, the older I get, the more comfortable I am with the feeling of just being embraced by the dynamic light of compassion and wisdom that in Shinshu we call Amida Buddha. It's very natural. But for me, having done the Zen style of practice and the Jodo Shinshu style of living, they just seem to meld together so that I don't see any conflict. So one of his essays, he has a book that I showed in the original screen called the Zenshin Talks. And one of his essays may give some insight into his thinking. And this, what it says is, I'll read this. "What is the purpose for which we practice religious and spiritual teaching?" And he says, "Meditation practice and listening to the teaching of Buddha is nothing but to know oneself, to open oneself, to open up one's self-centeredness and to expand into the vast openness, your immeasurable light of compassion and wisdom. It is like a small river of self that streams into a vast ocean, and becomes one in one taste of wisdom and compassion." So you're probably aware that Katagiri actually comes from a Jodo Shinshu family. So as a child, his parents were devout Shin Buddhists. And the biography that's on your website explains the karmic influences of how he became a Zen monk. And it was after World War II where Katagiri first requested ordination from a Pure Land Shin Buddhist priest, but that priest didn't have the resources to accept another novice at the time, but she knew of a nearby Soto Zen priest who needed to train Yi, so introduced them together. So Shin Buddhism was likely deep in his heart from the beginning. And there's another historical glimpse of cross references between traditions, and that this comes actually from the 1400s or the 15th century. So Ikkyu, which is, you know, I know he's not considered a conventional Rinzai Zen Buddhist monk, but I understand he was a friend of Renyo Shonin. And Renyo Shonin was the eighth abbot of the Jodo Shinshu tradition. So he's the direct descendant of the founder Shinran, as our tradition is a single lineage tradition. So during this period, I guess Renyo, to tell you more about Renyo, Renyo is highly regarded and he's considered the restorer of the tradition. And he established much of what is done in ritual today for us. But they had very likely had influenced each other. They were very good friends. And there are many stories that are can be found that talk about their interactions. And at the end of his life, I'll just tell you the one here. At the end of his life, Ikkyu said, "If people ask what is my opinion, tell them I also turned to Shin Buddhism." So I think there didn't seem to be much of a distinction between traditions for Ikkyu. So I don't know if those of you practicing Zazen might find devotional elements like what Ikkyu said. But maybe that may be a reason you may have even moved away from a past tradition. But it may be interesting to consider the devotional elements of Buddhist traditions and the idea of other power. So in Ted's talk with Arasanga, he spoke of self-power as bringing the self forward to adopt a practice, and other power as sort of a surrender. And he explained other power as the self, stepping back and letting things in. So in the Shin tradition, we often use the ocean metaphor. Let me just move on here. We often use the ocean metaphor in the self-power is like swimming across the ocean. Another power is getting on board a ship that will carry us across the ocean. And I've heard the analogy of the chicken and the egg, where Zen may be construed as the chicken picking its way out of the eggshell, and Shinshu is the warmth of the mother hen allowing for the shell to be broken. And I'm not sure if that fully characterizes the traditions, but to say that Soto Zen is exclusively self-power practice and Shin is exclusively other power maybe loses some of the nuances that bring into play greater meaning to both traditions. And one of my professors at the Institute of Buddhist Studies was Taigen Layton. He's a guiding Dharma teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate in Chicago in the lineage of Suzuki, and also a PhD from the Graduate Theological Union. And he wrote about Dogen Zazen as other power practice. I thought that was very intriguing too, and so piqued my interest. And he pointed out that Dogen was not an advocate for easy practice in response to this period of Mapo, or the decline of the Dharma age, like Shinran did. But he was also not advocating for a self-power practice that would allow for practitioners to accomplish great realization through their own efforts either. So he pointed out aspects of Dogen's teaching that assume acceptance and support from other sources. So these are the lineage of historical Buddhas and ancestors, the cosmic Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and the phenomenal world of the environment informed by Buddha Dharma. And for the sake of time, I won't go into these, but for Dogen, it was not an other power source of devotion like Shinran had in the vow of Amida, but there was a necessity of receiving support and strength from external sources with an importance of devotional gratitude to them. So I think Leighton's point is that Dogen's meditation teachings are involved with devotional gratitude for support from Buddha, ancestral teachers, bodhisattvas, and from the awakened Buddha land. To me, these ideas resonate with my understanding of other power. So I'd like to close with a story from the bishop in our Shin tradition that gives a perspective on the Nembutsu and other power. And it's applicable, I think, to our current situation, sort of the heavy weight we all feel during this difficult time in society. And this is a story by Reverend Marvin Harada. He's our current bishop. And it's a story giving an explanation of Namo Amida Butsu and other power. And he said, many people think that the Nembutsu or Namo Amida Butsu means that you take a big load off of your shoulders, like a big backpack, and you sit down and you let out a big sigh of relief, that you relax and feel relieved with the burden lifted from your shoulders. But I don't think that's what Namo Amida Butsu means. I think Namo Amida Butsu means the opposite, that instead you put a big load on your shoulders, a big responsibility or task, and now you have the power to stand up on your own two feet and move forward in life. That to me is what Namo Amida Butsu means. It's a power that comes from beyond our own ego self. It is a power that makes the load on your shoulders lighter than what it really is. It's a power that not only allows us to stand up on our own two feet, but somehow it feels as if it is pushing us up from behind. So relying on other power does not refer to relying on others to do what we should do ourselves. Rather, it is accepting Amida Buddha's power, the effort of others, and recognizing this will allow us to live our life to the fullest. When we become aware of the countless things that allow us to live, we cannot prevent ourselves from expressing what is in our hearts. And that is the voice of the Nembutsu. The Nembutsu is the basis of power for both the joy of living and for creating a better world. And this brings me back to my initial quotation from Reverend Agui that I'd like to reread for you. It is indeed true that one's life is not only one's life, or life of others' sacrifices. How can I share my life with others? And this is my understanding of what Jodo Shinshu Buddhists refer to as living the Nembutsu, the Bodhisattva path, and how to live with gratitude in my connections, really with all of you. So in closing, I'd like to say that I realize I made many broad generalizations about both traditions. And I hope you'll take it in the spirit in which it was intended in showing the connections and the interrelatedness of our lives in between our sanghas. So I look forward to more opportunities for our sanghas to continue to share and learn from each other as fellow travelers in the Dharma. And in the meantime, please stay safe and take care of one another. I certainly don't advocate grooming the face of your adjacent person there, but for cats, I think that's the best way to express that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Todd. I very much enjoyed your talk. It's very informative and inspiring. So gratitude to you and to your community.